Hi, everyone. I'm Natalie Gochner. This is Both Sides of the Aisle. I represent the political middle and have on the political right, State Auditor John Dougal.
Hey, Natalie. Great to be with you.
And on the political left, Shireen Gorbani.
Hello, all of you and listeners. Thanks for tuning in.
And thanks for your messages.
Yeah, we really love them.
I don't know where to start today. Just saying, whenever you see something like a...
Let's start at the very beginning. Well, it's a very good place to start.
Whenever you see a presidential candidate talking about if he doesn't win, there'll be a bloodbath in the United States, that just is so far beyond what is reasonable, what is, you know, in good form. It's just awful, John.
And once again, he's making a statement which can be read two different ways.
Well, what's the other way?
Well, the other way is if he doesn't get picked, then there's going to be a bloodbath in terms of the economy and the bad policies and everything else like that. And so he likes to state things in such a way that people can take it different ways because it gets lots of attention.
I've been a professional economist for over three decades. I have never used or heard the term bloodbath in relation to the economy. Not a single time.
But are you thinking about
that,
it now?
I've heard that many times.
A bloodbath in the economy? What's the metaphor?
Jobs are going to be lost. People are going to be out of work. It's going to be a bloodbath.
It sounds like, you know, saying it's going to be a dumpster fire in the economy. That's how you talk about politics. That's how you talk about elections. That's how you talk about civil disagreement is bloodbath.
Civil is a dumpster fire?
So I think what's happening here is that we are seeing Trump really going, now that he is the likely candidate in all respects, I think he's starting to crack under the pressure of the campaign. And part of it suggests to me that he really was, I think we've been paying a little bit less attention to him, but he was more disciplined in these months. And he has been, I think, distracted by all of the litigation, the multiple, you know, federal charges, 90 some. But now he's kind of back to the old script, right? And so we're hearing things that he's open to cutting Social Security if he's elected. There would be a bloodbath if he lost the election. He would pardon the January 6th rioters the first day in office. He doesn't think immigrants are people. Okay. And then he went on to say just absolutely inflammatory things about individuals who are Jewish deciding to vote for Democrat. I mean, like, it is back to the classic hits of a highly divisive, highly charged, highly violent rhetoric of a president who has a pattern of highly violent behavior. This is what we're back in for.
All grievance based. John, did you see that he's called for the jailing of lawmakers who took part in the House Select Committee that investigated January 6th. You know, so now we're talking about jailing
Fellow
politicians.
Opponents.
And then, you know, it's not a surprise to me, but our former Vice President Mike Pence said he cannot in good conscience endorse the former president. I don't think any former cabinet member of the Trump administration's endorsed him. The Republican Party, what is going on?
He has such a strong influence over such a significant portion of the Republican base that is a major factor. The other issue is when you compare and contrast the economy under Trump versus the economy under Biden, so many people look favorably at the Trump economy and look for it was better and
it was a completely fake economy with $1 in $4 were stimulus monies.
But
you know, you were getting checks from the federal government.
But even before COVID, think back before COVID, it was perceived as a much better economy for folks.
I don't know. So, I mean, unemployment is in below 4% right now. We finished 2023 with a 3% real GDP. It was forecast to be 1%. It hit 3%.
Well, so let's talk about this.
Yeah.
Joe Biden's sitting here going, hey, look, I've done so much for the economy and it's so great. And yet the American people feel like it's horrible.
Yeah.
So what is going on?
I have
a
theory about that.
Okay, what's your theory? Because so many people are looking and saying, okay, Biden's saying it's good, but it doesn't feel good to me.
Consumer sentiment is very low, both in our state and nationally. And yet people are spending like crazy. And you can't like figure it out. Where's the disconnect? And I think the disconnect is people are so set back by what's happening in our nation. Their feelings about our country, and then when they see the world on fire.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of pessimism. But the fundamentals aren't that bad.
Yeah, when I talk with folks, and it doesn't matter the age, you know, 20, 50, 70, the key theme is they're scared.
They're in a funk.
They're scared that they can't pay for college. They're scared that they can't buy a home. They're scared that they can't start a family. They're scared about their retirement. They're scared about whether they're going to lose their job.
Or so a complicated pregnancy.
Fear all comes throughout. It's kind of the common theme that I hear from lots of folks.
Interesting. Yeah, that's an interesting way. Hey, we should mention, John, so you're a candidate for the 3rd Congressional District.
Yes, ma'am.
And we're kicking you off the show.
Yes. Well, it's been great. This three-hour tour is wonderful.
The integrity of a program like this requires that there be some sort of buffer or blackout period between when there's an election.
Convention election.
So June 25th would be the primary election.
End of April is the convention.
And convention's coming up.
End of April convention. So,
bump it up against
We love meeting with you each week, but to our listeners, you're going to see someone who's going to
remember
jump
that
in.
Listeners. She said that
coming up real shortly here. Shereen, we should also talk about Trump being unable to secure the $454 million bond in the New York civil case. Wow. I mean, that was predictable, I think.
Predictable. So my understanding is the reason he's having a hard time securing the bond is that he cannot find the money. He has lots of assets, but issuers do not accept real estate. So he's unable to produce the kind of wealth that he suggests that he has. But maybe he'll sell enough gold tennis shoes to get there. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm just seeing a mess, Shereen and John,
Shereen is wearing yellow shoes.
The New York Attorney General, this Letitia James, goes out and starts taking these assets. Then through the appeals process, the fine gets reduced. And now you got to exchange the assets again. I mean, I just think it's a mess. But John.
Yeah, and for a lot of his supporters and others, they're going to look and say, you know, New York is unfairly going after him. And, you know, clearly he's got a lot of assets, but he doesn't have the cash flow to just put cash forward. Mm. And so they're going to see that this is unfair.
Mm. John, let's stay with you and then we'll jump to Shereen. But how about the House voting in favor of a TikTok ban?
Well, before you go there, let's talk about Georgia. There's, you know, six of the charges that were tossed out down there. And that's also going to feed the narrative, which is the prosecutor was overreaching with charges that got tossed out. Now, in theory, they can represent those and take them to the grand jury. Probably won't. But it's still going to feed the narrative, which is prosecutors are unfairly going after Trump.
Yeah. And just these charges lack detail. That was there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But
okay.
others remain, right? So
other
it's not
charges
it's
remain,
not that
yes.
this is like a complete clearing of the slate.
No, it was
it's
like
really
6 out of
41. It's really a narrowing
down.
And this actually does happen frequently. This is not unusual in cases that are complicated this, right?
Okay.
Like,
but I'm just saying it feeds the narrative.
It feeds the narrative.
Which is, yes.
I agree. But I think it's important for people also to understand. And I think unless you've had intimate exposure to our criminal legal system, we often don't understand how these cases work. And so I think it's important for people to just get a little context.
Right. But what it also feeds is, I think you and I have talked about this, the over-criminalization of lots of things in society and people getting crushed under the criminal justice system.
I mean, I'm not a fan of that.
You know, in the productive middle, I mean, John, I respectfully think that it's just a red herring to say it feeds the narrative from the standpoint of this narrative is so long. It starts with Access Hollywood and just goes from there. And I can think of dozens and dozens of disqualifying things that this former president's done.
But you're not a Trump supporter. If you are a Trump supporter,
sure.
Then
but,
this
but what I'm
resonates
saying to the,
with your
what
concerns.
What I'm saying to the Trump supporters is go lift up the hood, get past all these, you know, red herrings of things that feed the narrative why I'm going to stick with this guy, and just think about the morality of this candidate and the future of our country and try something different. I think it's really interesting. When the final numbers came out on Nikki Haley in this state.
Yeah.
Wow.
Pretty good.
She was impressive. I don't know. What, it was 46?
I think that's right.
Like that.
Yeah, I was going to say 45.
And this was in a jaded presidential preference poll.
Yes.
And she got 46%. I'm not a betting person, but if I were a betting person, I would
what
put
are the odds?
Money on it that if they had done a regular presidential primary mail out, mail back, she would have taken this state. Decisively.
I think it would have been close.
It would have been close. Interesting. Well, okay, Natalie, let it go. John, go
what
back.
What are the wagers? Come on, let's go back to
TikTok and the thoughts here. I mean, do we know how the Utah congressional delegation voted on this?
I don't. I think right now they're split in terms of the Senate. Romney is leaning for it and Lee is leaning against it.
Yeah.
Well, so this would force TikTok's Chinese owner ByteDance to either sell the media social media app or force a ban in the U.S. John, quick thoughts?
Well, I mean, the very first thought I have is, yes, okay, I'm very concerned with the Chinese Communist Party and them getting access to Americans' information, and they pose a threat. But I think Congress has much more serious concerns when they look at national security.
Mm-hmm.
And so this seems to be one of those that's kind of a distraction in the broader scheme of things.
Are you a TikTok user?
No, I'm not.
And how about your kids?
I don't know.
Yeah, I know mine are. But I'm not.
But it's one of those things. Citizens can turn off TikTok. There's an easy way for us to deal with that threat if we want to.
Yeah, I do feel like it's a moment where we seem to have some bipartisan consensus. This isn't the first time this has happened. There are other platforms that have been sold or forced a forced sale because of security concerns. And I don't know. I think it's interesting to me. I feel like the bigger issue here is who finds this more advantageous for their party and what, you know, what they want to do with it, as opposed to really thinking, I think, about the implications around security.
Mm.
But I don't know. Yeah. I think it would behoove us all to spend less time on social media.
Well, and I get concerned with the whole concept of nationalization. And while this isn't quite nationalization, it's basically saying you have to be owned by, you know, you can't be owned by certain foreign countries or investors in certain countries. And that whole concept, we see, you know, oil companies and so forth that we start in other countries and all of a sudden their governments take control of it.
Yeah. There are times when national security seems like it should be primary, but we should always remember our rights to free speech.
Yeah,
so interesting. Right. Hey, well, let's take a quick break. I'm excited to talk about border politics in our next segment. Stay tuned, everybody.
Shireen Gorbani on the left.
John Dougal on the right.
Natalie Gochner in the political center, and this is Both Sides of the Aisle. Shireen, I mentioned in the first segment we were going to talk about border politics, and it gets all mixed up in Supreme Court, you know, politics in a way, because SCOTUS just ruled that the state of Texas could go ahead and enforce their own sort of border laws, and then Appeals Court, you know, said, no, you can't. So you got this whiplash. But what do you think conceptually about the state of Texas having more control over who is in their state?
Yeah. Well, I mean, this issue really has far-reaching implications beyond Texas, right? Because now we're seeing governors in blue states, mayors in blue cities saying that this is what is happening at our borders, unsustainable. So it really, I think as much as we want to think about it as a Texas issue or red state versus blue state or red versus blue issue, it really isn't, right?
And I wanted to add to that, and also because if you become more strident in your border protection in Texas, the move just moves. Yeah, to New Mexico and to Arizona.
So I think fundamentally what I believe is some of the cruelty that's been on display at the border at the request of Governor Abbott is reprehensible. When we think about the razor wire, the kinds of dangerous, remember the flotillas, those kinds of things are the inhumanity around that to me is deeply objectionable,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
On the other, I guess there's not another hand there. That's period, full stop. But there is a problem,
mm-hmm.
and we need real solutions.
And we've shown that at least a good share of Congress was willing to come to the middle on it. But in the end, the far right and Donald Trump made it so it didn't happen.
And Donald Trump made it so it didn't happen. So for me, it's disingenuous to hear the kind of Republican outcry on this when they did have on the table for the first time in, 30 years more, a step forward.
Crazy.
Right?
John, have you looked into it very closely, the immigration bill that was...
I did. I actually read the whole thing.
Okay. Well, was it so bad?
There were some serious fatal flaws from my perspective in it, but there was a good framework. And I tell folks, given my legislative experience, what I would have done, because legislators have a hard time dealing with vague concepts. Once you draft something, then there's something concrete, a stake in the ground that you can shoot holes in and you can amend. And so I tell folks, what I would have done is taken that bill and spent several months, 3-4 months, trying to figure out a better compromise. I think the catch and release was one of the fatal flaws. The ability for people to keep coming across the border, you know, up to, you know, 5,000 people a day just crossing the border, just were fatal flaws from the Republican perspective. But there were other things that were good in there in terms of more asylum judges and trying to expedite the process. And so you could have taken that framework, worked to try and amend and improve it, rather than killing it essentially before it saw the light of day.
Well, how about...
But it would have taken a lot of time and effort.
How about approve it and then improve it?
Yes.
you know,
well, part of the challenge with that is
when you let the perfect be the enemy of the good,
we get this. This is what we get.
Yeah.
But Natalie, the problem is you released a bill and Chuck Schumer wanted to have a vote, what, 3-4 days later? Mm-hmm. It was released at 6 p.m. on Sunday, and he wanted a vote on Wednesday, which is way too fast for folks to have
that.
A chance.
I get that.
And so sometimes when you pass something that has a lot of problems, you're never going to come back and fix those.
Yeah.
And that's why you got to say, let's take the process. The Senate is supposed to be the thoughtful, deliberative body. They didn't deliberate on either side.
That's disingenuous.
They wanted to. Well,
there were negotiations between
three folks. Did it
4 months?
4 months. 4 months. Three people were engaged, very engaged. But when it came out to the broader body, it was expected to be rushed through, and that's where you got to take your time.
You know the term red herring. Do you guys know where that comes from?
Is it Agatha Christie?
Well, the way I think of it is, I'm thinking of, you know, the mother country. You're in England, and you're out with your hunting foxes, and you're trying to train your dogs, and you put some scents down some trails that aren't the foxes, just to kind of train them to stay on this true trail.
Yeah.
But they get pushed, you know, down the fake trail. And I just think so much of this is a red herring, this notion that, you know, three people talked about it, and so therefore it wasn't legitimate. That's often how legislation starts, with a small group that goes in depth. There's a lot of trust, and then they go defend it with their bodies.
Yeah. No, I'm not questioning the three people. I'm saying when it came out to the broader folks, it was trying to be fast-tracked through rather than let the process work. That's when you should engage more people in the debate.
Well, so why isn't the process still working? I mean, what we do know is that our former president said, don't pass this. And we do know that there's an election advantage to not passing it. That's a far more dominant, truthful kind of policy statement than this idea that, oh, they tried to force a vote too quickly.
Mm. No, it's on both sides.
Okay.
I'm just saying from a legislative perspective, you get into the scrum and you're going to spend months debating and trying to refine this.
As a policy person and not a political person, sometimes we let these red herrings take us off track.
Yeah.
Hey, let's feel the burn for a minute. Bernie Sanders has introduced legislation to reduce time off.
We're done. We're putting too much time already.
To 32 hours. I think it's so funny that he thinks that that's the role of government, to reduce the work week, Shereen.
So in many other industrialized countries, we do have shorter work weeks. Where does that come from? Is that driven? Do you know if it's in many European countries? Is that driven?
I would guess it's driven by unions.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. Okay. So I guess here's what I would say about this. Am I a workaholic? I don't know. I don't know. But I think it would be good to have greater benefits for workers in this country. I think when people are able to, you know, get fulfilling and be treated well in the workplace, that they are more productive.
Yeah.
That's absolutely true. I don't know that this is necessarily the role of government, but I would love to see stronger unions advance this kind of...
Economics always has these things, you know, guns and butter. One of them we have is work and leisure.
Yeah.
And I asked the question to our listeners, who's the best decider of how much leisure time you want or need? Or desire. And I would say you're the best decider of that, not your government. So this one drives me nuts. Well, any feel the burn on your side?
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of those things. You got these good intentions of, oh, people will work less and they'll have more time for other things. But as a business, you're doing trade-offs.
Yeah.
It takes a certain amount to, you know, you want to pay your employees, but you can only charge so much to your customers. You're trying to make, you know, break even or make money, because if you don't, you go out of business. We watched, you know, in California, wanted to raise, what was it, the minimum wage for pizza delivery drivers to $20 an hour, which essentially put a bunch of them out of work.
Yeah.
So the good intention of we want them to have more pay actually resulted in them having less pay.
Yeah, I guess I would just say there are many structures of our own society that make working 40 hours a week really difficult. When we think about the lack of access to quality childcare in our own state, when we think about school schedules and how school schedules often are really mismatched to the typical workday. I guess I would just say, if you're a listener and you're in a position of power in terms of, you know, employees or setting schedules for people, the flexibility that we can give workers to make sure that they're able to attend to their family and the real needs that they have is really good for your workforce.
I think the market's going to work here, because there's such a labor shortage going on that that workers will have a lot of power. Hey, let's go deeply local. Let's go to Utah's Capitol Hill and the Utah Education Association. Shereen and John, this one requires a tiny bit of background. You guys help me if I'm not doing this well enough, but our Constitution restricts
earmarks income tax historically to public ed. Then it was expanded out in
social services
to higher ed. And then a few years ago, it was expanded out to social services
for children. So you've got a major income source that's very restricted to three things: public ed, higher ed, and social services for children. Legislature wants more flexibility, wants to be able to, you know, weigh decisions.
Treat it like the general fund.
Yeah, I totally get this idea that it's a game that we have to play. So it's going to be on the ballot in November for all of you to vote to give more flexibility, complete flexibility to how the income tax is used. On the same ballot, you'll be able to vote to have the food tax, the state sales tax on food, removed.
State piece. Still have a sales tax on food, but state piece would go off.
And that's the biggest piece. Anyway, but the UEA, Utah's largest teachers union, has decided to take on this ballot initiative.
Yeah. So there was, I think we have a little bit of a, I don't know how best to describe it without being too inflammatory, but we have a pattern of behavior in the Utah legislature of coupling things that people want with things that people don't want, right? And so this is what happened with the food tax. There was a big effort to remove the food tax. This has been going on for quite a while, and we've had debates over whether
sure.
or not it's a
yeah.
good idea.
Yeah.
But there really is, I think, something to be said for the fact that it has the opportunity or potential to impact low-income families when we think about kind of the ways that they're making ends meet at their kitchen table. But when we go a little further than that, this piece of legislation was tied to this major change, and the education community stayed pretty quiet.
Yeah.
And now you get to vote. Like, you, listeners,
they,
you
they
get to decide.
They stayed quiet in 2023 during the session and 2024 during the general
yeah.
session, and
well,
now they're just barely coming out with their opposition.
Well, because now it is going to be in front of voters.
Well, the fact that they're doing this is a, you know, they wouldn't do this lightly. I think they're going to run a public information campaign to take care of this from their point of view.
Yeah, that may be. Yeah, I guess I would just say when we have, we often are struggling with the balance. I mean, thinking about where the revenue is coming into our state and wanting to have the resources necessary to address the kinds of programs that people want to fund. And when we're thinking about basic social services, your social services taking care of those who need it, right? And education. I think we undervalue that in our state a bit. So we have an opportunity to do better there. I'm sad to see this change being made, but I also understand that there are demands. There
I
are
worry
budgetary
what it
demands.
Says about dynamics on Capitol Hill, John.
Oh, yeah.
That this can set teachers back
oh,
if
yeah.
they're not
yeah,
careful.
Yeah. If you yeah. get in a major feud.
Let's go to Cache County. This program gets played a lot in the beautiful Cache Valley. Love that place. But we have the Cache County clerk/auditor, David Benson. He's had a tumultuous tenure, and it's all related to election missteps. And he's resigned with less than a year on the job.
Yeah, he's resigned. And I think
the previous one resigned before that.
But. Yeah. Yeah. So I guess I would just ask the residents of Cache County to take a really close look at what's been happening in your local government. And when we think about, you know, management or mismanagement, is it time for a change?
Mm-hmm. John, I don't know if you want to comment any further.
Cache County used to be one of those really quiet areas. And then, unfortunately, you know, we've audited them recently. They've had lots of contention in terms of their elected officials up there. And so it's one of those things. Citizens need to get involved. They need to make sure government is performing as they expect.
I was up in Logan yesterday and did a little work on the Cache Valley economy, but it's a wonderful place.
Yeah, I really love it.
Yeah, and they do a lot of manufacturing, which sets them apart. And, of course, the beautiful Utah State University campus. Trent Christensen, a Republican candidate for Utah Attorney General, not licensed to practice law in Utah. John, let's start with you there. I get the feeling that this will fix itself, but thoughts?
One of the questions is, did he need to meet these requirements before he filed on the day of filing? Or at the election, or when he takes office. The requirement in the Constitution is you have to be a member of the bar and in good standing before the Supreme Court. He doesn't meet either one currently. And so I think we will also start to see some changes. You know, I'm one of those that has concern that says any private organization that gets to control who your elected official is, I think, is a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And
that
so
sounds like you, John.
Yeah. So I think I'm hoping that the legislature will work to amend the Constitution to help clarify this.
Shereen?
Yeah, I guess I would just say it feels to me like maybe those are reasonable requirements, right?
Something to think ahead about.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense to me.
He is an attorney.
He's an attorney.
In another state.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess I would just suggest that maybe a person who is wanting to be that involved in Utah's legal system, I guess I don't feel very strongly, but I can understand that there would be benefit to having specific experience and practice here.
It does highlight one other concern is you've got the chief election officer, the lieutenant governor, who's on the election, you know, fundraising committee for one of the other attorney general candidates.
Sure.
So yeah. It highlights potential conflicts there.
Yeah. Well, great program, you two. So good to be with you listeners. Natalie Gochner with Shireen Gorbani and John Dougal. The program's produced by Anthony Scoma. Thanks for listening.
Thanks, everyone.